May as well go ahead and get started with today's lecture. Boy, I guess everyone is out there working on their study for midterms or whatever else is going on today. I thought it was just simply because you turned in your interim reports on Monday, you're all going to take it easy. And by the way, I have 400 pages that I'm going through, and I'm trying to manage 4 or 5 projects a day. Most of the stuff I've read so far, well written. Some of them have amazingly good figures, results, all kinds of stuff in them. But it's just going slow. I'm not sure if we're going to have all 20 projects graded to include in your midterm grade, which is due on Monday at noon. We'll let you know. But what I've read so far looks pretty good. I think the shortest one was 8 pages. The longest one, and I'm not counting the 250-page data sheet that was attached as an appendix. Someone attached the entire manual as an appendix. Okay. Well, okay. With electronics, that's okay. I'm not going to read it. Okay, but I will read the report. But I think they ran from about 8 pages to slightly under 50. So they're all over the place. And some are just a pleasure reading. So that's the update on your grade. And we will have some form of midterm grade by Monday, since that's the official due date. But we're not sure if it'll include your midterm report, which is, I think, the best indicator of what everyone's doing so far. Anyway, on that note, on Monday, we had Professor Maran Mirigani come in and talk about things like entrepreneurship, innovation, etc. What we're going to do today is we have Nick Perlini. Are you vice president or assistant?
Assistant vice president. Okay. Although, if you could promote me, please.
Okay, well, he's vice president. Okay.
I thought I got my paycheck next week.
But one of the interesting things is, okay, suppose you innovate and come up with something. What do you do with it? How do you protect it? And what has been going on, and this is very important, I think it came out a little bit in Mirigani's lecture, but you may not have caught on to it. Sometimes, you know, we tend to think of companies as producing products, but just as important to the value of a company these days is the intellectual property that it may have in a portfolio. This can consist primarily of patents, or copyrights, or other things. And there are companies which make their entire business upon just intellectual property or copyrights and patents. So this is something for you to really pay attention to. At the big companies, oftentimes instead of publishing papers, you produce patents. That goes on your resume, you get a little certificate, sometimes even monetary award. I'm not sure what it was like, for example, at GE. But there's recognition in the big companies, and this helps you. And in the small companies, it's just as important, if not more so. So with all of that, Nick, you're going to tell us all about intellectual property.
That is
I'm going to try and turn out that light.
Yeah, I tried and put some students in darkness earlier, so I decided to give up. Thank you very much. My name is Nick Perlini. I'm the university's assistant vice president for technology transfer. And this afternoon, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about both the technology transfer function at the university and intellectual property. I realize this is midterm week, so I thank you for coming. And I co-teach a graduate class with Miran. So if any of your fellow students didn't come because they were afraid I'd be like him, I'm sorry. I'm mostly kidding. Miran is wonderful.
You have a pointer already?
No. We have a great time teaching together. So let me tell you where we're going. For those of you keeping score, this is the introductory portion of the presentation. Once that's finished, I'll move through the rest of the presentation. Again, I'll try and keep this interactive or at least keep you awake. Feel free to laugh at me, throw things, whatever.
And remember, you're going to write a patent disclosure, so this is an excellent opportunity to ask questions, even relevant to your own projects.
Absolutely. I'll give you a little bit about why my my background and why you're listening to me, other than that you came to class, talk a little bit about technology transfer here at Case, give you an overview sort of what is intellectual property. We talk about it, we hear about it. Talk a little bit about patents with the caveat that this is a primer and that I am not a patent attorney as often as I am accused of that by people. Talk about intellectual property ownership and intellectual property rights, which are often two very different things. Talk about why intellectual property is important, both in small and large business. Plenty of time at the end for questions, but again, feel free to fire them out as we go through the presentation. So I'm the university's assistant vice president for technology transfer. That means I run the office that is charged with commercializing research created by folks like Frank and Maron and moving that technology out into the commercial world. I also run the university's internal $5 million venture capital fund, which is called Case Technology Ventures, and I'm an adjunct lecturer in the Department of Marketing and Policy Studies over at Weatherhead. I've been at Case for 4 years, actually 4 years last Monday, which is a little scary for me. I am an industrial engineer and an economist by training. I've spent the past 8 or 9 years in technology commercialization and early stage business development, both on the consulting side. I was at Accenture back when it was called Anderson, but Anderson is sort of a four-letter word now, so you can't say that. Spent a lot of time in commercial and investment banking, and prior to coming to Case, was director of a $240 million venture capital fund based in Saratoga, California, in the heart of the Silicon Valley. So what is technology transfer? Well, very simply, technology transfer is the process of taking ideas created in research laboratories and putting them into commercial use to benefit the public. Right? Innovations that we do here at Case, we spend about $340 million in research every year here at Case, do no good to anyone in society. By the way, most of that research money, about 96%, is from the federal government. So you're in my tax dollars at work here at Case. Right? It doesn't do anyone any good if those innovations remain locked up in a laboratory. Technology transfer's job is to get those ideas out into the marketplace. But because universities are nonprofit research and teaching institutions, we can't actively engage in producing product to sell. Right? We're not allowed to engage in business. So we give those rights to either new companies that we create or to existing companies that then take that intellectual property and turn it into products. Tech transfer has been around for about 25 years. Was started nationally in 1980 with the passage of a piece of federal legislation called the Bayh-Dole Act. That, for the first time, allowed universities to take ownership of results of research paid for with federal dollars. Prior to 1980, the government owned everything. And while the federal government is wonderful at buying things, it's not so good at selling them. And so the Bayh-Dole Act essentially allowed universities to take ownership of that intellectual property, and in exchange for that ownership, we agreed to do a couple of things. One was we agreed to take that intellectual property and try our best to get it out into the commercial marketplace. Two, we agreed to give preference to small businesses, minority and women-owned businesses, if we could. Three, we agreed that we would take the proceeds the university received and share them with our researchers. At Case, our researchers get 50% of our proceeds. So that means in the last fiscal year, which ended in June, we sent out about $4 million to Case researchers. The year before that, it was a little over five. So, and the final piece is that the monies the university retains have to be reinvested in light of the university's mission. So in the last fiscal year, we took about $2 million of proceeds and actually reinvested that in the university's research infrastructure to fund research projects. After this year, it'll be about $750,000 towards the EECS 2009 initiative, et cetera. At Case, the modern era of tech transfer really began in late 2001 when the university made a substantial commitment to revitalize the program, combine three separate offices into one, and bring in an entirely new team. Now, 4 years later, we've got 14 professionals dedicated to technology transfer, and our office actually leads the United States in a number of key metrics. So, how have we done? Well, we measure success in technology transfer across a couple of different metrics. One of them is the number of invention disclosures that we receive, and I know you are going to be putting together invention disclosures as part of this course. Statistically speaking, Case's results over the past couple of years have been great. It takes about $2.5 million in external research funding to produce one invention disclosure. That's about 128 to 130 a year here at Case. So we've done very, very well. Again, we're about double the level we were a couple of years ago because our faculty are becoming more engaged. And we're getting those inventions in. If we don't have those inventions, we don't have anything to commercialize. Right? This is sort of our innovation pipeline and is sort of our leading indicator of future success of the office. The other, perhaps more important metric, is how many deals are we able to do? How many agreements are we able to strike with companies in industry to take those ideas and push them out? And we've seen almost a fivefold increase over the past 4 years. We did 26 transactions last year. We've also started 11 companies over the past four years and have another couple in the hopper right now that we'll be announcing over the next couple of months. In terms of revenue, we've taken the office from making about $2 million a year to a sustainable level of $7 to $10 million. Tech transfer revenue can be lumpy. Sometimes you get lucky and you have a big deal hit. We had a couple of one-time gains in 2003 and 2004 for $4 million a year, which were nice. The researchers who walked away with $2 million were pretty happy about it. No one's going to complain.
But
we're working on it. We're trying. Like many institutions, though, we have one or two inventions that are responsible for the majority of our income. At Case, we have a patent on a particular bovine growth hormone. It's called a polyadenylation signal. I don't know what that means either. But essentially, it's one step used in the process of making a particular drug. The drug is called Rituxan. It will probably do close to $2 billion in sales this year, and we get a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of a percent every dose they sell. And because our patent isn't on the drug itself, the drug company really hates paying us. They really, really hate it. But they have to. And that's the beauty of intellectual property. They cannot sell that drug without using this step in their production process, and we have the rights to that step. And that amounts for an awful lot of our revenue every year. For the engineers in the room, I always like to put this slide up. At Case, engineering, frankly, dominates in terms of inventive performance. So the slide on this side of the chart on this side of the screen shows our external research funding last year. I put the Case College of Arts and Sciences up there in green just for comparison. Arts and Sciences is about 6% of the research budget. Engineering is 12%. 82% is other. That's the School of Medicine, but I don't like putting their name on my slides. One would expect statistically that you would see inventions kind of in the same proportion. It's not true. Engineering actually produces 37% of the invention disclosures we saw last year, 21% out of arts and sciences, and those other people do the rest. These numbers have been increasing. And while we would expect to see a higher level of inventive activity in engineering versus medicine just by the nature of the field, we actually see an incredible level of performance by our faculty and researchers. Case researchers in the School of Engineering produce three times the number of invention disclosures as the national average and the average across the entire university. So you are working with some of the most productive inventors in the United States here in the Case School of Engineering. Very happy with this slide. I don't show this when I'm talking at the med school. Okay, so what's the tech transfer process? Well, the first step is we receive and solicit ideas from folks at Case, students, faculty, staff, researchers. We go out and ask for invention disclosures. We do this by a number of mechanisms, departmental meetings, outreach activities, etc. Once ideas come in, they go through a two-phase process. The first phase is our evaluation, and there are three different criteria we look at. The technical or scientific merit of the idea, our ability to protect the intellectual property, and the commercial merit of the idea. Any guesses as to which of those three is the most important for our office? I heard. Okay, let's see. Hold on. Who says technical or scientific merit? Okay.
Frankly, I said.
Who says commercial merit? About half. Who says intellectual property protection? About half. Well, half of you are right. The other half aren't. Let me talk about these in reverse order. Technical or scientific merit. I'm an industrial engineer. People on my staff, I've got a chemical engineer, I've got a BME, I've got a double E. We understand the science, but our researchers are a heck of a lot smarter than we are. There are several thousand researchers across the entire institution, all of whom are smarter than me. And quite frankly, which isn't that hard, quite frankly, 99.996% of the disclosures we see every year are fabulous from a scientific standpoint. There is one disclosure a year from a particular researcher who shall remain nameless, generally comes in crayon or colored pencil, on cold fusion and Tupperware. I wish I was kidding. Stop by my office. I'll show it to you. Every year. So the science is great, right? Intellectual property protectability is sort of binary. We either can protect it or we can't, right? We need to look at how the work was funded to see if there are certain rights, if there are certain government reporting obligations, etc. But it's sort of binary. As we'll talk about in a little bit, as long as you didn't talk about it publicly more than 365 days ago, we can file for a patent in the United States. Whether that patent's going to have any value, I couldn't tell you. Where we spend most of our time is on commercial merit. Does anyone care? Is there an actual market for this technology? Would someone want to take a license to it and move it forward and bring it to the market? I'll give you an example of a technology we will never, ever file a patent on. There's a lot of wonderful work going on across the street, School of Medicine, in the area of malaria, working on vaccines and other preventive measures. Now, malaria is a terrible illness. It kills something like 2 million children every year. We will never file a patent on a malaria vaccine. Some of you may be thinking, Nick, you're a monster. Think of the children. The fact of the matter is, I am thinking of the children, and I'm thinking of the fact that they all live in third world countries. Third world countries have a history of not respecting intellectual property rights. So even if we obtained a patent in a country where there was a problem with malaria, the government would invalidate that patent in the interest of public health. You can't make money selling a malaria vaccine. You have to give it away. It doesn't mean you can't get research dollars from folks like the World Health Organization or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who would probably pay a drug maker like Merck to take that vaccine and make it at cost and give it to these third world countries, but it's not a commercial opportunity. Okay? How do we assess commercial merit? Well, there's a couple of different ways. One is, we spend an awful lot of time on our own networking in industry. We all have industry backgrounds, and we sort of know what's out there and can take a look and get a feel. But a lot of times, we're just not sure. So we work with the researcher to identify companies that we think should be interested. Now, every researcher, with all due respect, thinks their idea is the best idea they've ever done, and it's worth $1 million.
Two, in
some cases. I wish that were so, but it's not always the case. What we do is we say, okay, that's great. If our thoughts about where this technology can be used and your thoughts are correct, here are the 20 or 30 best companies in the world who ought to want this. And if they don't want it, well, we know something. We work with our researcher hand in hand to put together a marketing piece, generally 1 to 3 pages, an abstract that doesn't give away the invention. We call it non-proprietary, things you can talk about without giving away or compromising your patent rights. And we'll contact those companies. We're very directed. We're very targeted. If the companies show interest, we might move forward. If they don't, well, we probably don't. Generally speaking, about 1 out of every 3 ideas we see makes it through this first phase. So that means I say no far more than I say yes. Makes me very popular sometimes. Okay. For that 1 of 3 that makes it through, we start our second phase, which is our commercialization phase. We may try and help the researcher obtain additional money for more R&D. We'll work with outside patent counsel to file patents if that's appropriate, and we'll work very hard to try and license that technology. Now, let me give you some hard and sort of depressing numbers. If we pretend that we get 100 invention disclosures a year, right, roughly 33 of those will make it through that first screen. Right. Of those 33, about half, or 15, we will eventually be able to successfully license. And it may take between 2 and 5 years to actually get that license agreement in place. Of those 15 that we license, 2/3, or 10 out of the original 100, might actually break even. That means they might bring in enough money into the institution to cover the cost of patents and negotiating the agreement. Of those 10, half, or 5, might actually make $100,000 or more. And of those 5, roughly 1 out of 20, so do the math, will make $1 million or more. Statistically speaking, a very small fraction of inventions ever turn into real income for the institution. It doesn't mean they're bad things to commercialize. Remember, it's not all about making money. But it goes to show you that those researchers who think every idea they have is worth $1 million or $2 million might not be right, at least looking at the way the business model actually works. Any questions on tech transfer in general? I think you're still awake, so I'm going to continue and assume there are just no questions. Some of you in the back may be sleeping. All right. What the heck is intellectual property? IP, right? I've talked about it. You've heard about it. I'm sure Moran mentioned it.
But what is it?
Well, intellectual property is an intangible asset, right? That means it's something you can't always see it or touch it or taste it. But it might have substantial value. You can do a couple of things with it if you own intellectual property. You can sell it to someone. I'm going to give you this intellectual property. You're going to give me money. You can assign it to them, as you may have to do to your employer. If you work for Allied Signal and invent a new pH meter, you're going to assign those rights to your employer, generally for free. Or you can license it. That means you can give someone the right to use that technology and then pay you on an ongoing basis, generally a royalty based on sales. That really doesn't tell you what it is. I sort of told you what it's worth, but what is it? Well, a couple different kinds. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so pay attention to these legal terms. They're very complicated. There's copyrights. Copyrights cover written works, newspapers, books, journal articles, and software. Software is actually a copyrightable asset. Now, where it gets interesting is how long the period of protection lasts. So, first I'll tell you, to register a copyright is very easy. Right? You can actually get common law copyright protection just by putting copyright 2005 in your name, or Case Western Reserve University, or Allied Signal on your printed document. That gives you a common law copyright and protects you under U.S. law. If you want to be able to seek damages from someone for infringing on your copyright, you need to register your copyright. You do that by sending 3 copies to the Library of Congress. In the case of computer code, you send like the first and last page of the source code and a description of what's going on and a very small fee. It's registered. You get protection. But for how long? Well, I call it the Mickey Mouse clause. You get protection for the author's life plus 70 years. Or 95 years from the date of first publication, or in certain cases, 120 years from creation. How long is it protected for? I don't know. The fact of the matter is, the copyright protection statute keeps being changed every time the copyrights on the original Mickey Mouse characters come close. Disney goes to Congress and cries, oh dear, our copyrights are going to run away, whatever will become of us, and Congress extends the term to protect Mickey and Minnie and all their wacky friends. But the most important thing to remember is copyrights are good at least for as long as you're alive, unless you live to be about 100, well, no, actually, even if you live to be 140, protection's good for 210 years. Once a copyright expires, the work is considered to be in the public domain, and anyone can use it. That's why, for example, if you want to go and put out a book of Shakespeare's works, have at it. He's at least been dead for 70 years. Though I was just reading today, now they're pretty sure he didn't exist, but it's sort of a big argument. Unless you're Disney, don't worry about it. Assume the copyright is good for your entire life, and probably the life of your kids and grandkids. Another kind of intellectual property, trademarks, right? Logos, slogans, the mouse ears, the Nike swoosh.
The case Batman.
Now, Frank, you know officially the university's brand identity is the case logo. I can't even do it. The fat man holding a surfboard. Right, that's a trademark. Diet Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Apple, all those things are trademarks. How do you get a trademark on something? Again, you use the item in trade. I mean, you use it in commerce. You offer it for sale. You put it on a website. You sell it to your friend. Two kinds, actually three kinds of really trademarks. There is a regular trademark. That's the TM symbol. If you want to trademark something, an idea you've come up with, just put TM after the name. You've got a common law trademark. Right? If it is a name or slogan for a service, you put an SM. Is that a question?
Well, I was going to say, what about when your trademark becomes a common slogan like Kleenex?
Give me a second and I'll come to that. That's an excellent point. Xerox is probably the best example. Okay. If your name or slogan or what have you is for a service, you put an SM. That's a service mark. If you, again, want to be able to seek actual damages from someone who infringes, you need to register the mark. So with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, you file. There is a review period. If the mark is granted, that's when you do the circle with the R in it. Okay, that's a registered trademark. If you accidentally ever put the circle R in front of something that is not registered, you lose the mark permanently. So don't do that. It's bad. It's actually considered fraud under federal law, and as punishment, the mark is taken away from you. So don't do that, it's bad. Trademarks last for 10 years, but they are renewable. And you can renew them ad infinitum, forever. Question from the gentleman in the back is a good one. What happens if your trademark becomes a common word? I'm going to Xerox this. Let's FedEx that. Let's Google it. Well, you got a problem. Many companies like Xerox, like the folks that make Lego bricks and toys, not Legos, Lego bricks and toys, spend an awful lot of time and money to educate the public that their products are called Lego bricks and toys, and you should encourage your children to call them that, not refer to them as Legos. The reason they do that is you must demonstrate an effort to keep that mark separate. If you don't, and it enters the common vernacular, there's not a lot you can do about it. No one refers to photocopiers sitting on the Xerox machines, even if it happens to have a different brand name on the front. Most tissue paper is Kleenex in the United States. Nothing you can do about it. Most of these advantages are band-aids. Now, it's not all bad. From the company's standpoint, they can still prevent a competitor from using that name. And when people think about photocopiers, they tend to think about Xerox. So there are some benefits. It's why, for example, Google has not really tried to go after anyone for using terms like Googling. They're probably waiting to do something else with respect to copyrights later. And Google, by the way, is in a very interesting position. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about this, but they are about to essentially scan their goal, essentially almost every written work ever done, and make it all searchable by the Internet. There is a huge debate going on right now as to whether that is legal under what's called the fair use portion of the copyright law. That's sort of beyond the scope of my lecture, but if you're interested in copyright law, take a look at what's going on with Google and their digital library. It is absolutely fascinating, and if anyone thinks that Microsoft Corporation is a bit of a bully in the software world or an evil empire or uses its power inappropriately, take a look at what Google is doing to the book publishers and authors around the world and make your own determination as to which company is the greater evil. It's a fascinating look. I think there's going to be some really neat lawsuits over the next couple of years with respect to it. The lawyers are going to
look for opportunities.
That's right. The lawyers are going to get rich. That much I know. Don't know about anybody else. Okay, so those are trademarks. Now, next we have trade secrets. Ooh, trade secrets. Secret company information, like X47 or whatever the heck the formula for Coke is called, right? It's a secret formula. No one knows what it is. It sits in a vault somewhere in Atlanta, Georgia, 50 miles below the Earth's surface, next to Walt Disney's frozen corpse. And it's a secret. No one knows what it is. Trade secrets are good forever, unless they get out. If it gets out, it's not a trade secret anymore. And you can't do anything about it, according to my language. Unless you can prove that it was released. You can go after the person who released it, but again, once the cat's out of the bag, the cat's out of the bag. Universities, by their very nature, don't have trade secrets because we publish. Trade secrets go against the university's core mission of teaching, research, and education. Trade secrets can be a great way to protect your company's proprietary information, but you need to demonstrate internally controls to keep that information secret. As we're going to talk about in a moment, the one downside to filing a patent application is you have to tell everyone exactly how you do something. With a trade secret, you can keep that information to yourself. The final type of intellectual property are patents, and these are really for more things than you think. The term of a patent is 20 years, non-renewable. That has changed over the years, but it's pretty much 20 years now, so to avoid the Mickey Mouse discussion I had earlier, we'll just pretend it's 20 years in all cases and go with it. So what's a patent? A patent is a contract between the inventor and the issuing government, whether it's the government of the United States, European Union, Australia, whatever. The inventor receives a limited monopoly for a period of time, generally 20 years. During that period, they can exclude others from making, using, selling, or importing the invention. So if you have a patent on the soda bottle in the United States, you might not be able to stop someone in China from making it, but you can prevent it from being imported into the United States. What does the government get in exchange for giving you this contract, this monopoly? You have to disclose the best way to create the invention. And when that patent expires, that invention, that technology, enters the public domain. In the same way that once a copyright expires, the work enters the public domain. It's interesting to note that in the United States, the power of Congress to create a branch of government, an office of government, specifically designed to recognize and reward innovators, is in the United States Constitution. It's been there since 1789. The framers of the United States government realized that it was important to encourage innovation, encourage entrepreneurial thinking, and reward it. And so, in fact, the groundwork for the modern Patent and Trademark Office was laid down in the original draft of the Constitution, which is sort of a cool fact. But here's the thing. A patent is the right to exclude others. A patent does not give you the right to make, have made, sell, import, whatever is in your patent. Why is that? Well, the answer is other patents may overlap yours, or what's called dominating your patents. Let's pretend you have a patent on this particular soda bottle. Everything about it. Its thickness, its shape, its design, its style, its construction, the method by which the screw on the lid is attached. That's wonderful. You can keep someone else from making this exact bottle. But you yourself may not be able to legally make this bottle. Someone else may have a patent on plastic beverage containers that might not specify the exact design, might not specify the exact way that screw-on lid is made, but the claims, that is the part of the patent that matters, we'll talk about that in a moment, may cover broadly all beverage containers. So, you can keep that company that owns that broader patent from making one that looks just like yours. But you can't make this, because their patent is broader and dominates. There are three kinds of patents in the United States. Utility patents, these are the most common. These are the way things work. Design patents, how something looks. And plants. Yes, plants. But only asexually reproduced plants. Don't know what that means, but I'm sure a botanist somewhere cares. So what can you patent? Well, pretty much anything. Processes, machines, manufacturing, composition of matters, business methods. Right now, computer software. Frank's giving you some interesting articles on whether or not that belongs there, but right now it is. Living things. Yes, you can patent mice. Believe it or not. Someone has made a fortune by taking a particular mouse. They knock out a gene or two so you can use the mouse for specific kinds of research. And they have a patent on it. It's neat. If you want to use their mouse, there you go. Genetic engineering materials, again, asexually produced plants, trees, grapevines, and flowers. I guess it doesn't matter whether the trees, grapevines, and flowers are asexually produced or not, but those are the only exceptions. What can't you patent? Natural phenomena. You can't patent lightning. Sorry. It's been done. You can't patent natural laws. Gravity, sorry. You're not going to get it. It's not going to happen. You might find out something wonderful about the way quantum mechanics actually works, or interesting stuff about the way neutrinos behave, under certain conditions, but you can't get a patent on it. You also can't patent abstract ideas. Right? Time travel. No. And finally, perpetual motion machines. Sorry. We don't care how good you think it is. It really doesn't work. You cannot patent it. Don't try. Of course, you can patent really bizarre, stupid, worthless things. My personal favorite example is a method to amuse a cat or other domestic animal with a chase instinct by means of a light-emitting device. Anyone here have a laser pointer? Anyone have a cat? Ever put the laser pointer, have the cat chase it? Yeah, you're infringing. Don't do that. It's an unenforceable, absolutely worthless patent. There is another patent that was recently issued to an 8-year-old. I think he's probably 10 or 11 now, on a particular method of swinging by holding on to the swing adjacent to the one you're on. I have a former patent examiner in my office. He swears he was not involved with that one. You can get a patent on anything if you spend enough money. There are a lot of absolutely worthless, ridiculous patents out there. If you want to amuse yourself, do a web search for bizarre or crazy patents. There are sites with pictures. There was one I saw, it's the most risque thing I will mention today, was a method for assisting with labor by putting the mother in a centrifugal motion machine and kind of spinning her around. So. Here's the diagram. It's a U.S. patent. It's legitimate. There's a U.S. patent on it, and you don't have to prove that the idea works. Okay? You don't have to do that.
You might mention the models, though. Those were always fun.
I'll let you.
This is a really big thing, because for the longest period of time, you had to produce a model of your patent. These things were absolutely cool. And I forget, when was it that they decided that was no longer required?
You just have them drawing them.
Yes. Then they had multiple warehouses full of these models. And I think it was about 1960 or so.
Yeah, I think this is very...
selling them off. And there are people out there that collect all these weird things.
And some of them are beyond bizarre.
Go on to eBay and look for patent models.
Just don't do it at your place of business if you have a job, because you might get fired. Some of the things that... It's amazing. So what is a patentable invention? It requires a couple of things. First is conception. Right? You have to have more than a vague idea. You have to know how this idea would work. You also need to do what's called reduction to practice. Right? That's either building a prototype, or, frankly, in the United States, writing down a series of detailed steps that someone of ordinary skill in the art, that is someone in the same field as you, I don't know what the people who amuse cats with light pointers would feel they're in, but could follow your instructions and execute them. A couple of things. In the United States, and only the United States, the first person to invent something gets the patent. Even if they haven't filed for it, even if IBM files a patent and spends a lot of money, if you can definitively prove that you invented it first, it's yours. That's why many researchers and many companies have... Yes?
Is there a legislation to try and change that?
There is, and I'll get there in just a moment. Most of us hope it doesn't change because we think it's a mistake. This is why many researchers, most companies require their technicians or their research assistants to sign their lab notebook at the end of every day. Some companies actually have every page on every notebook notarized at the end of every workday. Again, this is to prove that all-important date of invention. Right? The rest of the world, the first person to file a patent application gets the patent. But Matt, if you're the first inventor, if you manage to get your patent application to the office first, you win. Now, as the gentleman in the back noted, there is a movement to reform the patent system in the United States. Some people wonder whether or not that reform is needed. Most people in university technology transfer don't think that it is, at least not to the extent that's being proposed. What's being proposed is called harmonization, that is bringing our patent laws in line with the laws in the rest of the world. I would argue that our Constitution recognizes the importance of valuing that first inventive person, the person who truly created it first, not the person who copied it or came up with it second. It's too early to tell whether that legislation will go through Congress. Right now they're a little occupied with other things. So we'll see what happens. As a result of... The rest of the world, you know, operates under something called the Patent Cooperation Treaty, which we're a party to, but we maintain the right to kind of do our own first to invent versus first to file in the United States. From their point of view, they think it's just as fair to let whoever gets there first have it. It's just a philosophical difference. And, you know, it just is what it is. Again, most countries have not had patent systems in place as long as the United States. By the way, if you go with a first-to-file system, you avoid all the litigation and all the need to prove who was the first inventor. You look at the postmark on the application, and it doesn't matter. So they've eliminated an awful lot of administrative burden, perhaps at the expense of recognizing an original inventor. But again, it's something that they felt is a reasonable trade-off. Citizens in those countries and their elected officials have felt it's a reasonable trade-off. the United States. We'll see where it goes. It frankly is too close to call. I think there will be some patent reform passed. I don't know which provisions will survive the final negotiations between the two houses. Okay, some limits. You can't get a patent if the object you're trying to patent is already in common use. Probably not going to get a patent on a simple piece of wood used as a doorstop. You're not going to get a patent on a checkers set. You might be able to get a design patent. You're not going to get a patent on dirt. Just people have tried. You can't get a patent if it's obvious to someone who's skilled in the art. Let me tell you what I mean. Let's say we got a patent that discusses, go back to my soda bottle, method of making and form of making this clear plastic soda bottle. You're probably not going to be able to get a patent on making the green one. If it would be obvious to a polymer chemist, all you need to do is add these five dyes, which are well known, to make the plastic green. If it's a very reasonable, logical leap from a previous invention to yours, you're not going to get a patent. And in the United States, if the information was released more than 1 year before the application, generally in a printed publication or discussed in a public forum, you cannot obtain a patent. Yes?
How did the person with the latest point ever get the patent? That would be fairly obvious to one who deals in the art of making patents.
Well, the examiner didn't think. A lot of people with patent office don't have cats. The fact of the matter is some things slip through. And if anything important were to ever slip through, there would be a litigation. Someone would sue someone over it. I don't think anybody's going to sue that with a cat patent. Yes, sir.
What, teeth and cats?
In general. Well, if something is, there's a concept of prior art, things that exist before your invention. Examiners are supposed to search the prior art and determine whether or not this invention is covered by something out there. It can sometimes be difficult. In fact, information flow has been increasing to the point where examiners don't always have access to the best information. It's only been recently that examiners have got internet access at their desks. I know, it's scary, the federal government. So that sometimes helps things slip through the system, right? They don't have access to that prior art. Obviousness is, frankly, a somewhat qualitative description, right? Is it obvious or isn't it? Probably depends on who you ask. Depends on the examiner's area of expertise. I also believe in some cases, patent examiners decide that fools and their money ought to be parted and are happy to allow patents to issue because it's an expensive process. And the gentleman with the cat and the laser pointers is probably wasting $10,000 or $15,000 of his money on a patent that he can't enforce. By the way, if you disclose something, you immediately lose all foreign rights. So if you have a new idea and you announce it at Research Showcase next spring, you can't file a patent in a foreign country. And you'll have 1 year to file in the United States. Foreign rights.
Now, does that apply to senior project presentations?
What's the forum?
The class.
Probably a public disclosure.
Your class is ticking.
1 year. 1 year. So how does one get a patent other than spending a lot of money and hoping they get the same examiner that looked at the laser pointer? Well, you take an application, and you technically can write it yourself. Don't. And you send that application and some money to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. An examiner then reviews the application, eventually. It can take 6 months. It can take 3 or 4 years. We had one application that actually sat on an examiner's desk for 4.5 years before we got a response. I see enough of the responses to allow it and give us all the claims, but 4.5 years. Every couple of years, a story comes out of an examiner leaving the patent office. They go to clean out his or her office. They always move the ceiling tiles. Because examiners have a bad habit of throwing things up in the ceiling tiles, and there it is. Examiners always reject your application the first time. They come up with things that they think are related, they say are related, and find ways to basically disallow all of your claims. The part of the patent that says, we claim a plastic soda bottle with these characteristics, with a screw-on lid that works in this manner. Your patent attorney, or you, then goes and has negotiations and discussions back and forth on the patent application with the examiner. This is called patent prosecution. It can take 6 months. It can take 6 years. Eventually, if you pay enough money and enough fees, a patent might be issued with specific claims that define the scope of your patent. Generally speaking, you can get a patent on anything. What matters is how many claims do you get and how broad are those claims. If you file a patent application on this bottle, and at the end of the day, the only claim you get is the way the little bit at the bottom here is formed when it's pulled off the machine. Probably not worth the money. But you have a patent, and you'll get a pretty copy with a gold ribbon on it signed by the head of the patent office, and you can put it on your wall. How much does this cost? In the United States, it can cost anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 for an engineering-related application. If you're looking at the life sciences, probably twice that. If you want to look at countries outside of the United States, take $15,000 to $20,000, multiply it by the number of countries in which you want to file your application, and then add about 25 or 30% for foreign language translation costs. It's expensive. Case spends about $1 million a year on patent prosecution. It's the largest single line item of my budget, next to salary and benefits. We spend a ton of money on it, and we don't spend that much. Patent prosecution is big business, both in the United States and everywhere. So let's pretend that you've managed to get a patent. Who owns it? That's a good question. If you're a researcher at a university, or you work in industry, or you're a grad student doing research at a university, or you're an undergraduate student working on a co-op or an internship, it might not be you. The IP rights might belong to your employer. It depends on how your employment agreement, how the faculty handbook, how the graduate student handbook, etc. reads. So a good question to ask as you're looking at jobs is, who owns the results of my work? The answer, by the way, will always be, we do. The best you can hope for is, if you think of something totally unrelated to the company's line of business at home in the shower, you might be allowed to have it.
But that's not always true.
Very true. That's your best case scenario. Unfortunately, the way modern industry works, if you work for us, everything you think belongs to the company. And as Frank said, if you invent something and we get a patent on it, we'll give you a little plaque and maybe a check for $100 or a watch. And that's pretty much the way it works. Now, if you work at a university and are a researcher, your university will share some percentage of the proceeds with you. As I mentioned earlier, Case has a 50% share with no upward bound, which is the most generous, frankly, in academia. Many universities, it's more like 25 or 30% with a cap, but that's not where Case is. So there is unlimited income potential, though, again, the odds are kind of small.
But remember what you want.
No, it's true.
There's a researcher at the University of Illinois who has a patent on function keys on your keyboard. That is very lucrative.
Well, and as we'll talk about, patents are really big business. Again, ownership and rights are different things. Ownership means it's mine. Rights means I have the right to use it. People make money from intellectual property by selling it, assigning it, or licensing it in exchange for some form of compensation, right? Generally, this is done with a license agreement. And you can do a license agreement for patents, for copyrighted work, or for trademarks. Right? Merchandising, right? People have a t-shirt with an NHL logo on it, or an NFL logo. That was probably licensed, unless it's counterfeit. Software, those little end-user license agreements that everyone just clicks through without reading. Bad idea. You don't actually own the software that you buy. It's a little ridiculous. If you go and drop $50 for an Xbox game, you don't really own it. You own the piece of CD that it's, you own the media that it's on. But if you read that license agreement that's in there, the ownership actually remains with the company, and you, the mere mortal, are merely given certain rights to use it for your own enjoyment. It's that simple. Universities, frankly, tend to license patents and occasionally trademarks more than they do copyrights, but it can't happen. Who cares? Well, it's big business. Character merchandising, Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Transformers, Barney, $2.6 billion a year business in the United States. Universities bring in millions every year from licensing revenue. Actually, it's billions. Have you heard Gatorade? Yeah. Certain Florida university doesn't have a patent on Gatorade, the formula of salt water and sugar that's in the bottles. They have a trademark on Gatorade. And every year it brings in tens of millions of dollars to that particular institution. It's wild. And the best part about trademarks is it lasts forever. Gatorade's been around for quite a few years and probably will continue to be. It's huge business. Patents allow companies to maintain or protect market positions. Amazon, speaking of software patents, somehow got a patent on the concept of clicking once to buy something on the internet. It's ridiculous. Patently absurd, quite frankly. But they've used it to protect their position. They and Apple, which has licensed that technology from them for the iTunes Music Store, are the only two companies where you can click once and have it automatically delivered and charged to your credit card.
I thought some company in Virginia actually had a patent and was suing Amazon.
It's up in the air. It's an issue. There's a lot of question as to the patent's validity. Look at Microsoft. Microsoft uses copyrights and their closed-source software to maintain their market position. They're the only folks that can sell Microsoft Windows. They're the only folks that can, you know, sell Microsoft Office. They've enabled and created these dominant market positions, and copyright law protects their works. Okay? But, as was alluded to, patent litigation is a huge business. We love suing each other. It's a lot of money. Usually, the only people that get rich are the lawyers. SCO is suing numerous users, companies, individuals of Linux for alleged copyright infringement. This entire company exists just to sue people. It's fascinating. We'll see what happens. Elos, which is a California-based company, sued Microsoft for infringement of patents related to web browser plugins. Again, a patent that probably should never have issued and will probably be thrown out later. The initial award was $520 million. The folks that make the Blackberries, Research in Motion, have been sued by a company that maintains that the RIM technology infringes on two claims in a couple of their patents. A court has recently awarded that company a couple of $100 million and ordered, though not agreed to enforce, an injunction basically saying that RIM can't provide BlackBerry email service any subscribers except those in the government. Hasn't enforced, if you've got a BlackBerry, it's still going to work. But what's even better is at the same time this court gave this award to this competitor, the Patent and Trademark Office made a preliminary ruling throwing out all of the patents. It's a mess. It's going to take years to sort out. And my personal favorite, Apple, is suing Apple.
Not the same apples.
Not the same apples. Beatles Record Company. It's once again suing Apple Computer over the use of the name. They sued them. It's probably the third or fourth lawsuit because they're afraid people are going to confuse Apple Computers with the White Album. Sure, why not? It could happen. It's absolutely fabulous. We'll see where it goes. These are multi-$100 million lawsuits. It's fabulous stuff. A new thing has started called nuisance lawsuits, where people get a patent or say they have a patent that may or may not have any validity and will basically send a letter threatening to sue and offering to settle for $10,000 or $20,000. Many corporations just write checks because it's easier.
It's a great way to pay for grad school.
I'm not going to comment on that. Where it gets even more entertaining is there was a recent federal court ruling that says, and I love this, that, let me back up for a second. There has been what is called a fair use exemption under patent law, essentially, allowing you to use a patented technology for your own education, amusement, purposes, research, etc. Universities have always operated under the belief that our activities, because they are of their nature, educational oriented, that we don't necessarily need a license to things that we may be practicing. A patent decision came down, maybe v. Duke. The gist of it is, if I'm an inventor at Case, and I invent this soda bottle, and the university has the rights to it, gets a patent, and I leave Case and go to the University of Illinois,
I can't work on my own invention anymore. It's fascinating. It's silly.
We'll see where it goes. So, I've babbled enough. I thank you for your attention. I hope I've given you a little bit of insight into tech transfer and IP. We've got some time for questions, if there are any. Throw them at me.
Okay, come on.
Well, I bored you all to death.
Fundamental question.
Bored you all to death. I'm sorry.
Is your senior project patchable? You know, here's a way to get a step up on that assignment coming up.
No one.
Come on.
That is invalidated by the fact that it costs $15,000.
Well, there is that.
Well, actually, the first question is, how many of you are thinking of going on to law school?
If you are, intellectual property law is an incredibly boring but lucrative field.
Yes, I was in a simple lawsuit, I guess. 120 claims at stake over beef fat, French fryers for McDonald's. The legal fees alone in the case were over $75 million. Not to settle. That's just the law. That's the legal fees.
Did it have to do with McDonald's variable second?
No. No.
I've got a question. Yep. I think that a lot of companies, are just filed for this tremendous number of patents that you're like Microsoft gains some 5 or 10,000 patents every year.
Yes. Absolutely. What you are finding is a couple of things. One, companies are filing more and more patents, sometimes just for the heck of it, particularly prevalent in the life sciences, where folks will file what are called telephone book patents, where they will literally basically say, we had a target, and we think every compound they have like this, and they'll start literally dropping genetic sequences, would activate it. And then they find out which genetic sequence actually does what they want it to do. Hey, let me file this patent on. Companies are doing it defensively. They're filing patents just so they can say that they did, just in case. Most companies end up filing a lot of provisionals. They don't always convert those. But what you're finding is the value of intellectual property is being recognized, and we are starting to get more and more intersection and crossover by patents from different companies. So an example, Creative Labs, which made the Rio player and now owned by somebody else, has got a patent on a hierarchical menu interface for an MP3 player. Now, whether you could get a hierarchical patent, whether you should have been able to get a patent on that is up in the air. I kind of think those menus have been around for a while, and I think it's just pretty logical to assume if it works on a computer, you could put it on your MP3 player. They might sue Apple. How much could they get? Don't know. They have an efficient file. They've said they're going to. They probably will. What will probably happen is Apple will probably give them $100 to $200 million and say, go away. I'm serious. It's cheaper than filing a claim. What Apple doesn't want is an injunction. They don't want a court to say, yes, we believe you are infringing on their patent, so we will enjoin you from selling AirPods. That will be bad.
Unless you're selling them on eBay, in which case the price will go up.
Well, very true. But the fact is, particularly in the area of consumer electronics, computer software, it is becoming big business. People are seeing it, and I think the lawsuits will spike and skyrocket. I don't think the patent reform legislation currently in place will do a lot to curb that, even though that's the plan. We're going to see more and more suits. And I actually think we'll start to see things that impact Joe Consumer, because I think at some point, maybe not RIM, but some provider of some cell phone is going to suddenly be told, you can't enable this feature.
Yeah, I think a bunch of ASICO cell phone providers just got told you can't sell you ASICO phones.
Right. And the fun part is, it will take years to sort out whether or not they are infringing and whether or not the initial patent should have ever been issued. Here's what's scary about patent infringement cases and why most people suffer. People like us are the ones that sit on the jury. The jury pool and the federal district court wherever the case is brought, hears that claim of infringement, right? They're people from the community. They're not scientists. They're not experts. And so, if you're Apple, and you have to get sued in, let's say, West Virginia, are you from West Virginia?
Of course, Utah.
Or, anyway, if you're from Apple and you have to get sued somewhere, do you want people off the street making a determination as to whether or not a highly technical patent with hundreds of detailed claims applies to your business or not? It's a big deal.
That's right. I mean, this is really fascinating because I've been involved in things, you know, where you're behind the mirror watching, you know, these firms will bring in like 20 people from the area. In fact, there are people that get paid to be fake jurors. And the attorneys will try and make simple arguments to them, you know. And it is so difficult to get across an advanced concept, let alone the differences between two concepts. It's almost impossible. I remember our biggest problem was keeping one of the prospective jurors awake during the argument.
And as difficult as it would be for Apple, let's pretend you're Genentech and someone is suing you because they think your drug uses a step they created. And now we're going to get jurors and try and explain to them advanced drug manufacture, drug design, and interaction between different proteins. No way.
Yes.
You're going to settle. You're going to write a check. The lawyers are going to take 40% of it, and that's going to be that.
Oh, those are rather good attorneys.
Well, only 40%. I'm being nice.
Wow.
It depends. Other questions? Instead, if you're becoming a patent attorney, become a litigator, you'll make a fortune.
Oh, yeah. They don't even bring in the litigators until the last step. They're really highly paid.
Yeah, a patent attorney in Boston, partner level, makes about $500 to $600 an hour. And that's not a litigator, that's for somebody that writes patent applications.
Sir? Do you think what happened in patents is that way? If somebody came up with an idea and it was just, if they wanted that to be their idea, it's their responsibility to keep the secrets?
Well, you could do that, right? You can use trade secrets to do just that. That's a good question. I think patents actually encourage innovation. It encourages risk-taking because if you are successful in creating something new, you can get this limited monopoly. Other people would make a counter-argument that patents discourage innovation because they're expensive and most people don't even try. I don't think either answer is necessarily right or wrong. But I don't know if that's the question whether I have to answer.
I was just going to say, it's like they encourage it, but the cost of efficiency for small people, for small businesses.
It's a function of the reality of the modern times. And you can follow that page on your own, you don't need an attorney. You can download guides and information and resources from the patent office. You can get the entire patent examiner's guide and understand all the regulation. And it is possible for an individual to get a patent file and get it issued. But, you know,
is it worth?
That's the thing. If it really is worth something, if it is a valuable patent, if you can't make more from your patent than it costs you to get it, you shouldn't patent it. It's not worth enough to file a patent on.
This is why you better work on your business model first.
And if you're trying to use cats, I'm sorry, it's already been taken. Dogs, hamsters, probably are covered too on the whole prior art thing, so you're probably going to get that patented out. Any other questions?
Oh, not a last one or two.
It's midterm.
Where did the 8-year-old get the money to buy it?
Now that's a real good
mommy one. And daddy have way too much money to spend.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it great when you can go into show and tell at school and bring in your hat?
I think you should have to get a license to have kids, but that's a whole other kind of licensing. We won't go into that.
Now, out of curiosity, anyone in here have a cat? No? Okay. Sometimes it shows up. I mean, we've had people come back and co-op with cats.
For you?
Yeah. That's happened before.
Did you have a cat?
Oh, I've got a bunch. getting all these letters that for some work I did. I'm getting patents all around the world. Oh, no, they're just spending money supporting his terms. But it is part of a corporate strategy. I call it the shotgun approach, because what you do is you get as many patents, hoping that what you're going to be able to do is exclude your competitors from an area in which you're putting your product. And this is becoming really big in large corporations.
We had breakdown days where you take apart other machines and your competitors and you look for stuff. One of the purposes was you look for something where they may be going, actually, there is none. If you patent it first, then they can't go there.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing you'd ever produce yourself.
Now, we didn't even get into the wonderful world, although remember way back when I gave a talk in design, I mentioned reverse engineering.
Yeah. Breaking it apart to see if they might be infringing on something we do have. It's huge business. I mean, there are firms out there that help companies look for infringers. They help companies identify possible infringers. And as I said, a lot of times folks send out a note, I've got this patent we think you're crafting. I mean, we get a couple every year here at Case. We have this patent we think one of your researchers is using and send us money. We throw them away.
Nice try.
But it happens in a lot of big businesses. Even if the number is $10,000, $20,000, it's cheaper to pay that than to even respond to a court action.
I remember when I was in my club, the compensation you get from GE here in Cleveland is greater if you find a patent infringement of something the company's done than if you actually generate a patent. The guy cut.
So it gets you?
No, it was a cool.
Oh, okay. So, but you see now why we're paying a lot more attention to intellectual property in here, because that can be the end result of your engineering design effort. You may not actually build anything. And I was going to say, it's just IP, but these days, that's actually what you want. Isn't it interesting? Okay, well, let's thank Nick for breaking up. And I think I really will threaten him by sending him all of your patent disclosures. And he tells me there's a brand new university for
with
instructions, though.
Oh,
this is good.
Well, the innovation is not about instructions.
Is that patentable?
No.
We'll get it online for you, or we'll get a deep link, although that's probably a violation of a patent.
No, you're probably okay. I just emailed it to you. If you want to learn more about our operation, our office, techtransfer.case.edu. You can actually download our latest annual report that just came out and get some forms for more information. If our office can ever be of assistance on 64 Sears, just stop off. Thanks.
Yeah.